This is Conor Lennon from UN News. Nuclear power has been a source of optimism and fear since the mid-20th century. On the one hand, it evokes the destructive power of nuclear bombs, the catastrophic explosion of Chernobyl, or the Fukushima disaster, or, more recently, the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant in Ukraine, Europe's largest, which has come under fire since Russia's full-scale invasion began in 2022. But the image of nuclear power got a boost at the end of 2023 at the COP28 UN Climate Conference in Dubai. The 198 countries represented at the conference included nuclear energy in their list of low-emission technologies that need to be scaled up if we're to succeed in decarbonising our economies. In addition, 22 countries committed to tripling nuclear power capacity by 2050. Earlier, I spoke to Rafael Mariano Grossi, the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, and I asked him if he thinks nuclear is likely to become more popular and mainstream as an energy source in the coming years.
Well, it's been very important in terms of public perception, in terms of policies, in terms of public understanding. Nuclear is already playing a big role in clean energy delivery, so to speak. To give you an idea, more than a third of clean energy produced today in the world is nuclear. Or in Europe, where I live, half of the clean energy which is produced, by clean I mean CO2 free, is of nuclear origin. So it is already part of the solution. The problem is that for many, many years, for a variety of reasons that have to do with Chernobyl or later Fukushima, etc., there has been a lot of pushback. There have been what we believe from the IAEA has been misinformation about what nuclear energy is or is not. So in this sense, there has been, and we take this very, very seriously, there has been societal, in some places, not in every place, in some places there has been societal concern about nuclear energy as a technology. So this, of course, reverberated into the conferences and meetings and policy gatherings about energy in general, so much so that in this process of the big conferences on climate change, the so-called COPs, no, in these places, nuclear was very resisted, not talked about, not mentioned, and sometimes even rejected as a whole. So I think it is a Copernican, you know, step when you go from that to say, as it was said in Dubai, that nuclear energy alongside renewables should be accelerated. So not only tolerated, not only accepted where it is already, but accelerated. And coupled with that, a number of countries, important countries in Dubai, as a parallel event or a side event, as people say these days, they committed to triple their own percentage of nuclear energy. So I think sometimes people ask me, so is this a renaissance of nuclear energy? I like to say that this is a return to realism. It's a return to realism because people who are not necessarily in the nuclear area, I might cite the International Energy Agency, which is one of the most, if not the most respected think tank of energy issues, or the International Panel on Climate Change, which is a gathering of the greatest and the brightest scientists from all over the world studying these issues, have recognized in their modeling that without, if you take away nuclear energy from the equation, decarbonized by 2050 would be almost impossible. So what we say is, yes, there's going to be acceleration. And in this thing, we will have to, and the IEA and the UN system in general, which we represent in this sense, will have to be very present to make sure that this happens as it has been the case as up until today, in a safe way, in a secure way, in a way that does not promote proliferation of nuclear weapons. I mean, what the IAEA does as part of its mandate, because its mandate is bigger than that. But that is my general take on your question.
Well, I just want to pick up on a couple of things you said. First of all, you said talk about the misinformation in the wake of disasters such as Chernobyl, Fukushima, and the societal issues surrounding that. Can you give me some examples of the sort of misinformation that you're countering?
Oh, yeah. The conventional wisdom is that thousands of people died because of radiation in Fukushima. Not a single person died because of that. Thousands of people died because of the tsunami. But there was no victim as a result of radiation. It was a big accident. It was a bad accident. Let me be very clear. We analyze accidents. We need to prevent them. So I'm not diminishing or in any way banalizing what happened. But there has been this accepted idea. The same goes to Chernobyl, where people say that millions of people are dying because of cancer, etc. There have been some cases. We have studied it with the WHO, with the United Nations Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation, UNSCEAR, and other specialized bodies. And it has been very limited. When you look at the statistics, the stats, all right, not policy papers or propaganda, right? When you look at the stats, even from the WHO, you will see that in terms of mortality, nuclear is even lower than some renewable energies. So when you take the perspective throughout the years of the safety record of energy, two big accidents with enormous impact, and we need to tackle those things, and we have done it squarely. And addressed it and talked with people and explained what happened and explained what kinds of safety measures are taken. I like to be very clear in these things. And I think we need also, we owe people the information. Many people die in air accidents, and it's not because of this that you're not going to be using aircraft anymore or from other accidents in any other industrial activity. So I think there is a big responsibility also upon us and national governments as well to keep societies well informed and to set the record straight. This is what we say. We are not the IAEA, as we are known. I mean, the global agency for nuclear non-proliferation, for nuclear technology, etc. We are not a nuclear lobbyist. What we want is when this happens, it should happen in a good way. There has to be a promotion of the activity in a way that is good. But there has been a lot of misinformation. In some cases, perhaps with good intention. In some other cases, perhaps commercial interest. I don't know. I will not get into that. What we know is that there has been for many decades a certain narrative. And the reality proves otherwise. And what we see is, for example, a very interesting aspect that is happening is that some important environmentalist or green parties, as we know them in Europe, are pro-nuclear now. Who would have said? So, green parties in Scandinavia, in places that have had a very strong tradition of protection of the environment and the nature, they have studied the thing and they say, well, this is what we need. And it's a good solution. Does this mean that you are going to have nuclear energy for all 100%? No. We believe in intelligent energy mixes where nuclear energy is what we call a base load energy. It's very stable. It's there for you, come rain, come shine, you can regulate it, you can integrate it in what it is called integrated energy matrices with renewables, for example. We think that this is a perfect match in many countries. So this is the case. And what you will see in countries that use nuclear energy is that on average, you will have, of course, countries that have 80% nuclear energy like France, but you will have more or less 20%, 15%, this kind of percentage, which provides your grids need stability, needs to be stable, needs to be there when you need it. In the winter, when you need heating in the summer, where you need water, when you need maybe air conditioning, things like this.
Let's turn up to finance now, because now, you know, you've been at COP28, you've been to these UN climate conferences, you know that one of the big issues that comes up all the time is how are we, developing countries I'm talking about in particular, going to pay for this? You said 50% of the energy in Europe is nuclear, but it does cost money, doesn't it? There needs to be a lot of money up front to pay for this. Where's that money going to come from?
Well, there are different issues here. When we talk about developing countries, we see that in the global south there is nuclear energy. In India, if you want to consider China, still a developing country. In Argentina, in Brazil, in Mexico, in South Africa, in many countries. Now you are seeing even more. You are seeing nuclear in Bangladesh, you are seeing nuclear in Egypt, you are seeing nuclear in Gulf countries. And many African countries are interested in nuclear energy, in particular due to the development of small modular reactors, which are, as the name says, smaller units, therefore more affordable units, which make nuclear more affordable at the reach of middle-sized countries or middle-income countries, if you wish. There is another problem or another issue that we are starting to look at, which is the fact that in part, because of what we were saying in the beginning of the conversation, about narratives and policies that were nuclear hostile, there's no international financing for nuclear, unlike for renewables. For renewables, you have all sorts of incentives, subsidies, etc., and we celebrate that, let me say it again. But there are no funds available for nuclear. Only now, because of all of these factors that we are considering, what is happening, the COPs, the policies that are being decided by many countries, international financial institutions are starting to revisit the issue. Development banks, for example. Let me put an example. For a country, middle-income country, you know, a modular reactor, three units of modular reactors, 300 megawatts, something that can cost $3 billion, you can power the entire country, or you can desalinate, you can do so many things. And we are not talking about the billions that you need to finance big projects. So the whole structure is changing. There will be more of the traditional nuclear. We see that a lot, because the nuclear energy element is present, I would say, in different tables, like parallel chess games. It's present at the climate change table, is present at the, of course, developmental table, but is also, and very important these days, present at the energy security table, where many countries, in particular in zones close to political tensions, let's put it like that, they rediscover the autonomy, the independence that nuclear energy gives. A nuclear reactor is something that you switch on and it can go. You know that these days we are approaching 100 years, a century. We are already at 60, 70 years of operation with security and safety refurbishments. They can go very close to 100 years. So these are a number of changes that are taking place. And we are accompanying this process, of course.
I want to zoom out a bit and just go back to the central remit of your agency and what you do. And there is this, some might say, a strange double hat approach. We've been talking a lot about the benefits of nuclear energy and you know, the potential. But then at the other hand, you have this security side. And if people know you at all, what they probably do know you for is they will have seen you going to Ukraine, to Zaporizhia, yeah, and all the diplomacy you were doing there to because there was real fear about what could happen if that huge plant came under attack. So how do you reconcile that? You've got, on one hand, you've been advocating for the benefits, but on the other side, there's the security angle. So do those two go together? Because in a way, they could seem a bit contradictory.
Well, I would say I would look at it in a different way, Connor, if you allow me. I would say that what has happened, for example, in the case of Ukraine, has been the decision to occupy a piece of infrastructure and therefore automatically making it a bone of contention in a war. So here the problem doesn't lie in the technology, it lies in the war and what is happening around it. We have 440 something nuclear reactors operating in the world without any hiccup or problem. So this is a phenomenon that we need to, and this is why the agency has been so proactive and jumping, you know, right into the problem to avoid an accident. But this is, I would say, an aberration in the system, and it's not a norm or a trend or a tendency that these things are happening. So we see it, we take it very seriously, but we take it as a case, very serious one, indeed, very serious one, because it's the largest, biggest nuclear power plant in Europe, 6 nuclear reactors, so in a zone of active combat. But does this, you know, make it, you know, in the United States, you have 100 nuclear reactors, in France, 50-something, China will soon have 90, 20-something in India. And these are really forces for good, and they are not in any way threatened. At the same time, and I think it's very important that we discuss these issues, because like any important industrial activity, it does carry risks that need to be managed in terms of what happens with the nuclear material, in terms of the waste. You didn't ask me for it, but it's a classic. People will ask, what about the waste? And then I'm always explaining the waste is managed. The amounts of waste are very limited. There are technologies to do that. 70 years of commercial operation, never a problem with waste, etc., etc., etc. And then, of course, politics is a choice. You have the nuclear waste, you know where it is, and it's even inspected. The waste of fossil fuels, you don't even see it, it's killing the planet.
Well, yes, you have answered that waste question for me, so thanks for doing that. Now, I know you're getting to the end of the time, and there was one more thing, and I was talking to your team quite a lot over the last few weeks, and they sent me lots of interesting information. So here's your chance to talk about some of the lesser-known applications of nuclear technology, and they were very keen to tell me, don't forget, we are the only UN agency that has labs.
Well, yes, we have a fantastic campus of laboratories where we do all the technical cooperation science that goes into, let me simply enumerate them. We would need another chat whenever you want. But nuclear technology is oncology, is radiotherapy. And we do this. We give the technology, we provide the capacity building to developing countries to do this. Nuclear energy is the ability to provide food security through irradiation techniques that prevent harvests from rotting, or that allow the development of seeds that are drought resistant, or that allow the eradication of insects through the sterile insect technology, which is basically irradiation, and allow countries to avoid Zika, chikungunya, even malaria, Mediterranean fruit fly, and things that go into the billions in terms of the problems that all these phenomena cause into nature. We are working since COVID, we have been working on the early detection of pathogens and zoonosis. We have a lot of work on isotopic hydrology. You want to know that your aquifers you can use, where are they, how old are they, do they have arsenic or not? Can we do all these things? So that is the other side of the IEA work and of nuclear technology for development.
Well, as you say, we will have to come back to you to get into more depth on some of these topics. But thank you for this very comprehensive roundup of what you're doing. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Grossi, and we will talk to you again soon.
Thank you very much, Connor. Bye-bye.